You know, there are just so many Bible accounts that, you know, as people read this account, they're just so encouraged. And by the way, if I didn't mention, that's Joshua chapter 6. We're not going to be doing any lengthy readings because you're so familiar with it, but we'll be looking at some verses from time to time in there. And you'll remember the spies had spied out the land, and they had brought back their intelligence reports to Joshua and the military people and talked about Jericho itself. And we don't know how elaborate Joshua's plans were, but after they had came back, you'll remember that Joshua met with the real commander of the army, and he ended up changing his plans a bit. Now, if you can think of yourself behind the fortified walls of Jericho, we're told that through archaeology that they imagined those walls to be double walls. And even though the army of the Israelites had had some success, the people there probably felt a little bit of comfort, but they knew this was a strong army. They knew that they had crossed over the river. They knew that they had had some success in the battles that they had fought. And they were probably hoping that these double walls were going to prove to be impregnable for this Israelite army. But God promises Joshua victory. But he comes up with a curious strategy. He outlines this approach that they're going to do. He orders Joshua to march around the city once a day for 6 days with armed men in front of the procession. And they were going to be followed by 7 priests, each blowing a ram's horn as he marched. Then they were going to be followed by carrying the Ark of the Covenant. And then they were going to have a rear guard of armed men. And specific instructions were given that the people of Israel were to march silently. And on the 7th day, as you'll remember, they were to rise at dawn and march around the city in the same manner. How many times? Remember? 7 times. 7 times. And on the 7th time, what was going to happen? You remember? The priests blow the trumpets. The people were going to shout with a great shout. Now, I'm not sure how much the people really knew about the walls falling down, but that was the instructions that they received. And if you think about this military strategy, I don't think they teach that at West Point. I'm just not familiar with that kind of military strategy. I was in the military, and even though I was an air traffic controller, I was in the 1st Armored Division, and I don't recall a single time when we went out and did war maneuvers in the field and practiced that kind of strategy. I was in 1st Armored Division. We had a lot of airborne weaponry as well as armored vehicles. And thinking back on some of those events, even though it was a long time ago and my memory is not the greatest in the world, I don't remember a single time when any of the military leaders at that particular time said, what we're going to do, we're going to practice just marching around silently the enemy, and then all of their defenses is just going to fall down. Just didn't happen. Didn't make much sense. And I can only imagine if they said that that's what we're going to do, the way they would have had that message received. But I believe that theological message of this story is what? God teaching us to trust Him. He's teaching us that, and He taught the Israelites, that it's not about cleverness. It's teaching them to trust in Him. And this isn't the first occasion that God has used some kind of odd strategy to teach them to trust Him. You'll remember in the New Testament a passage that we read often, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 22 to 25, Paul said, Jews request a sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. To the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Now that's a passage that you're familiar with. We read it often. We talk about it. But in reality, in today's vernacular, what's he saying? He's saying God doesn't do business like mankind does. And why is that? Why does God not do business like mankind does? He wants us to know it's Him. God's ultimate strange strategy is revealed in the cross of Christ. We were talking about the cross of Christ in class this morning. We were studying the crucifixion and how terrible it really was. What man or what plan would have come up with that for the redemption of mankind? That terrible, terrible crucifixion. That's just not the way mankind does business. This doesn't appear to be the way to conquer the world. The Romans were not impressed. The Romans wouldn't have been impressed. What would the Romans have been impressed with? What were they used to see? They were impressed by the circus, the military parades, the spectacular events. What's that remind you of today? Takes a lot to impress us, doesn't it? You know, I catch myself, there's a show that we watch some called America's Got Talent. And I see people doing all this crazy stuff, balancing and swinging and doing wild, crazy things. And, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm reading the book most of the time, and it may be on in the background, and they're doing some pretty wild stuff. And I'm thinking, oh, hum. And some of this stuff, you know, the guy's flipping and they're doing all this choreography. And this one, they were using a human person to do jump rope and stuff. And I looked up from my book and I've seen that before. That don't impress me. And it's just, you know, it's just got to get bigger and bigger. And we just don't appear impressed anymore. It's going to take something pretty big. And it's just got to get bigger and bigger. The Romans needed something to impress them. They didn't do business the way that we did. They knew how to lay siege to something. They would circle a city, cut off the food supply, cut off the water supply, and then move in. They knew how to lay siege to a particular place. But in Philippians, one of the things that impresses me is that the Apostle Paul, and I get the idea that this guy was not an imposing figure. You know, all the things you read about Paul, we don't have any pictures and we don't have any, what do you call them things? Selfies. That's it. I had to think for a minute. You know where people hold the camera up? I mean, everybody's got a camera now on their phone and everybody is taking pictures. I see a picture of myself. I don't want that. I look at that and I think, who's that old guy? You know, I don't want no selfie. We don't have any selfies of the Apostle Paul, but I get the idea. He's an old fellow, and he's kind of haggard. He's worked his life. He's been stoned. He talked about his thorn in the flesh. On one occasion, he talked about he was writing with large letters, and so I get the idea. He's got a little bit of infirmity with his eye, and the Romans, what'd they do? They locked him up for preaching Jesus, put him in prison. What'd he do then? He converted the guards. This guy is trouble. And what does he tell them? He says, if you kill me, I'm going to go home and be with the Lord, which is better by far. And if you let me live in prison, I'm going to continue. Of course, I've got to have guards for prison. I'm going to continue converting these guards. And if you let me out of prison, I'm going to go back to preaching Jesus. Here's this scrawny old man. He had just checkmated the entire Roman Empire. That's the cross of Christ. That's what it was all about. He had just checkmated the entire Roman Empire. You know, but it seems unlikely that the Israelites could conquer Jericho by walking around the city silently once a day, with the exception of the seven priests blowing seven trumpets, and increasing the number encirclements to seven on the seventh day, and then breaking the silence with a trumpet sound and a loud shouting can hardly cause the walls of Jericho to crumble. There had to be a better strategy to bring about some victory. That was as unlikely as God becoming a man and dying on the cross to save the world, wasn't it? But yet that's what we believe, isn't it? Rising from the dead, offering forgiveness and new beginnings, it doesn't make sense. Why should we have a fresh start? Why should it be about grace? Why shouldn't we work really, really hard and it be about works if it has to be that way? Nobody gives us anything. It should be about who works the hardest. But the Bible says, and we know it, you know it as well as I do, we'd become braggers and puffed up and brag about that if it was based on those things. God has a way of turning everything upside down, doesn't he? A way of turning our whole lives upside down. But no doubt the inhabitants of Jericho are first paralyzed with fear. Can you imagine being behind those walls? First off, the warriors would probably be up on the wall. You know they're coming, so your strongest guys are going to be there on the wall. You're thinking they're going to lay siege, here we're ready. And of course, they don't have the sophisticated weaponry of today. They're going to wait close enough to, like the saying says, see the whites of their eyes, because they don't want to waste any of their firepower on these guys. They want to make sure everything counts. So here they come. Here's the line of the Israelites marching toward the city. And before they get there, what do? They break off rank. And they start marching around the city. Silently. Just walking around the city. They finish. And they go back to camp. The warriors have been ready. You're scared. Everybody's hiding at home. You see this little display. And now it's over. Well, that was kind of odd. Well, the next day, here you're ready. They do the same thing. And you're thinking, what is going on here? By the third day, it's become an interesting obstacle. Everybody's watching. Nobody's ready to fight. Maybe even people are kind of like you watch TV. They're up on the wall saying, hey, come here, I want you to see this. The last 2 days and the third day, it happens the same way. And by the fourth and fifth day, I mean, it's just become something you do for a pastime. You're up there watching these crazy people come and just march around the city. Excuse me. Pretty odd, isn't it? But we know what happened. Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 6, it says, Not by might nor by power, but my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. It was by God's power that it happened. More than 1,200 years later, the Hebrew writer said in Hebrews chapter 11, a passage that we know all too well, he says, by faith they crossed the Red Sea as though they were on dry ground. When the Egyptians attempted to do this, they were drowned. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after being encircled by the Israelites for 7 days. So we know the passage well. But it says those walls fell by faith. Now I don't pretend to know how faith caused those heavy-duty walls that the archaeologist tells us was double walls to fall down. But they said it wasn't by anything other than faith they caused them to fall down. Chapter 11, verse 31 goes on to say, by faith Rahab the prostitute received the spies in peace and didn't perish with those who disobeyed. And he goes on to tell of different people and the great things that they did. And I can't hardly read that passage without continuing down to verse 37 and 38. Because it says they were stoned, they were sawed in two, they died by the sword, they wandered about in sheepskins, in goatskins, destitute, afflicted, and mistreated. This is the phrase I just read it over and over again. It says, the world was not worthy of them. The world was not worthy of them. What a phrase. They wandered in deserts and on mountains, hiding in caves and holes in the ground. And then back to the account in Joshua chapter 6. When Joshua encountered the commander of the army of the Lord, what did he do? In verse 6 through 19. It says he fell on his face and worshipped. And when the commander of the Lord's army said to him, take your sandals off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy, the scriptures say that Joshua did so. Joshua had learned that obedience becomes the sign of whether or not one's worship is authentic. The guiding principle for Joshua was that once the mind of God was indicated, there was nothing more for him to do other than what? Just obey. Just obey. He just did it. God said, this is what you're going to do. And regardless of how foolish it sounded, he just did it. We have no record of him saying, but God, that's got to be the goofiest thing I've ever heard. And I think I would be tempted to say, you know, but Lord, you know, I respect what you said, and I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. But I got to make sure I heard this right. You know, Joshua just did it. And when we come to the point of what Joshua did, you just do it. That's a breakthrough. Our tendency, I think all human tendency, is to want to argue with God. Remember when Sodom and Gomorrah was going to be destroyed and Abraham's nephew Lot was in the city, what did Abraham want to do? He wanted to argue about it. He wanted to bargain. He wanted to play Monty Hall with God. Let's make a deal. And I can respect Abraham up to a point. He was concerned about his family members. And God, up to a point, was willing to deal on that situation. And I think we all have a tough time learning those things in life, that it's that God does know best, because we deal with some difficult situations. And I don't know if you've noticed it, but we're not going to get out of life alive unless the Lord comes back. It's going to be hard. He never promised it to be easy. And that's why I get so upset with these people that preach the health and wealth gospel. The health and wealth gospel only works for the guy that's preaching it, because everybody else is sending him money. So it's a good deal for him. And you know people like that. We can ask, can mankind improve on God's way of doing business? When I was thinking about that very situation and thinking back on the illustration in the days that I worked as an air traffic controller, years ago the aircraft that you fly in weren't as sophisticated as today. Most of the airliners today have colored radar, but still a lot of pilots use the old storm scopes. They're kind of black and white. They don't have any depth perception or anything like that. And what can happen, the weather radar in those aircraft, you're looking straight at a storm, and you can tell there's storms out there when you're in that aircraft, but you can't tell that there's waves around them. And air traffic control radar is designed to give you some level 1 through level 6, and you can see the better idea of where to get around weather. But yet, due to liability issues, you can't force the pilot to get through a certain situation. You can recommend certain things. And you could encourage pilots, okay, I see this, and if you'll do, you know, go this 25 miles on this particular heading, I've got a way around this level 5 thunderstorm, turn back to the left to heading 360 for about 10 miles, and it'll take you around that level 5 weather. And then other times they would just say, I give up, I'm turning around. Other times they would say, no, that doesn't look good to me, because they could not see their way around it. All they could see is one dimension. But yet God sees the big picture, and he understands the end result. And it doesn't mean it's always going to be easy on our part, but he does see the big picture, and he does have our ultimate good in mind. This incident of Joshua falling on his face in worship and listening to what God has to say and going back to camp obedient is just such a good example for us in our lives to learn obedience from. As he did that, I wish the Bible had recorded his generals and their reaction to it, because they had to have some idea as to what to do. Now, we don't know the full description of what he told them, but they had to know what they were supposed to do. As Joshua comes back and tells them, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to march toward the city silently, and we're just going to march around it. Don't attack. Don't do anything. Just march around the city silently and then come back to camp. That's all we're going to do the first day. Second day, same thing. And I can just see some of the guys that had been with him for a while. Okay, Josh, let me get this straight. We're not going to attack. We're not going to say anything. We're not going to do anything. We're just going to walk out there in the open, silently, and just walk around the walls For 7 days, we're going to do this. Okay. And then the walls are just going to fall down, right? Okay. Sure thing. They didn't remove him from power, did they? From his office of being their general or their commander. They did it. But it makes you wonder exactly what transpired in that situation where he told them about that. Just don't know how much he told them. Straightforward trust and obedience on the part of Joshua. One might say, well, God hasn't always been telling me anything recently, or sure, if God came down to me like he did to Joshua, I would do exactly what he had to say too. When we obey that strategy, whether we live in affluence or poverty, this life will be one of Christian success. And I say Christian success because that's different than the way the world measures success. You can be extremely unsuccessful, but yet be extremely successful in the Christian world. There is a tremendous difference. The world measures success differently than the way God measures success. And that's one of the things that we need to keep in mind. So many times over the years, as I've gone to different churches, I've seen churches measure church leadership by success in the material world. Now maybe that has something to do, but where are those same people as the years have gone by? Their faith was so shallow that when anything difficult happened, they folded. That was not Christian success. We need to be of the mindset that no matter what happens, nothing shakes our faith. I mean, no matter how hard it is, no matter what happens to us, that our faith is there. Bad things happen to Christians. But yet, faith is the abiding principle that continues. When you lose that, you've lost what really does matter. You've lost the anchor. The boats are adrift all the time. But your anchor is your trust and faith in Christ. That's where success really comes from. This generation needs that message. Sometimes it's hard to convince others to do what's best for their own good. You know, we think about our kids sometimes, and we try to convince them to do what's best for them. What if your child, and some of us, it's been, you know, a long time since we've had a child, starts first grade. What if our child went to the first grade, 6 years old, comes home and says, you know, that was fun, but I'm not going back. I enjoyed it. It was a nice time. Got to meet people, interact a lot. We did a lot of fun things, learned a lot, but I'm not going back. That's for somebody else. It's not for me. And I'm sure at that point, you just, because we don't want to force our children to make any decisions that, we don't want to force anything on them, do we? We want to let them grow up and make their own decisions. We just say, okay, that's fine. When you get older, you can decide yourself. That's exactly what you do, isn't it? Yeah, right. You know, I know what you would do. I know what every parent in here would do. I know what every person that's not a parent that thinks they know what they would do in that situation would do. They too, I mean, you'd put them out the door. I remember as a kid, I didn't like to lie, and I didn't like to brush my teeth. But brushing your teeth is good for you. And your parents always ask you before you go to bed, what do they ask you? Did you brush your teeth when you're a little bitty kid? Well, sure. Well, then they wised up. Did you brush your teeth tonight? See, they got smarter as time went on. Oh, tonight, okay. Well, see, if you didn't want to lie, what you then said, go check my toothbrush, it's wet. Right? Y'all didn't do that? Go check my toothbrush, it's wet. I didn't lie. My toothbrush was wet. And then it occurred to me one day when I got a cavity. They're not in pain when that dentist stuck that needle in my jaw and took that drill and was drilling. I was the one paying for that mistake. And you know, just like my dentist in Greenwood says, this is going to hurt you a lot more than it hurts me. He's a very good dentist. Most of you probably know him, Brett Donovan. I knew him when he was a little kid. That's scary to go to a somebody that you knew as a little kid that's now going to stick sharp objects in your mouth. That's not right. Anyway, he does a fantastic job. But the point is, he knows I'm definitely afraid of dentist. And he does a tremendous job. But the point is, we are in situations where we don't always do what's best for us. But yet, we try to instill in our children and those around us that God knows what's best. And we try to encourage them and push them into doing what's best. We talked this morning in class about the rich man and Lazarus. One of the scariest thoughts I have is to think about what judgment would be like. That rich man tried to convince Abraham to send Lazarus and convince his family, do not come to this place. Did he want to have a family reunion in hell? No. He loved his family. And anything that would have kept his family out of that place that he was at, he was willing. Was he afraid he was going to hurt their feelings? Oh, no. No, Abraham, please, don't send Lazarus back because he might hurt their feelings. Or, you know, regardless of the situation. No. He wasn't concerned about their feelings. He wasn't concerned about any of that. He was concerned about them and their souls, and that's what matters. In our situation, our commander is Jesus, and he's not as severe as a military commander, but he gives us every opportunity to obey. So much so that we sometimes begin to take him for granted. And in that situation that I just talked about with the rich man and Lazarus, it's about what pleases God and not what pleases us. And in thinking back in the Jericho situation, on that seventh day when those trumpets sounded, the people shouted, and the walls of Jericho fell down, Joshua obeyed not only the strategy for battle, but also the instructions that the Lord gave him in the moment of victory. He gave safety to Rahab, honoring the promise of the two spies. He ordered the people to keep themselves from particular objects that were to be destroyed so as to avoid trouble that would come upon them. He gathered all the silver, gold, and vessels of bronze and iron, which would be sacred to the Lord. Joshua obeyed, and he led the people in obedience. Joshua 6:20 says, so the people shouted, and the trumpet sounded. When they heard the blast of the trumpet, the people gave a great shout, and the wall collapsed. The people advanced into the city, each man straight ahead, and they captured the city. And these people, maybe they were on the walls watching the spectacle at that particular time, and my goodness, they probably were shocked out of their minds, because up to that time, they'd just been marching around silently. Not much had been going on, and all of a sudden, their world changed. And that's like so many stories we read about. We grow accustomed to just the everyday things. Nothing new, nothing's different, and then all of a sudden, it's too late. It's too late. And in telling this Old Testament account of what happened over 3,000 years ago, it's not just a lesson about the past. It's a lesson about today. Jericho has been a heap of ruins during all these years. The Romans built a new city a modest distance away. And today there's a city referred to as modern Jericho, and it too is some distance from these ruins. The intent of looking at this morning is not talking about these old people. It's talking about the fact that we've got some Jerichos in our life. Probably every single one of us have some Jerichos. And this morning, in closing, I want you to think about a couple things, and I'll leave the lesson with you this morning. What are the Jerichos in your life? What are the temptations that you have? What are the points of your spiritual warfare? Only you can answer that. Question 2, are you letting God handle that spiritual warfare? Are you taking what he said and applying it just like Joshua did? Joshua took what God said, and there was no arguing with it. And you know what? We're in the same situation. When the Bible tells us what to do, there's no arguing with it. We need to apply it. It's hard sometimes. It's not something we want to hear. It's not something to go around. Joshua was given the victory because he took what God said, he applied it, and God gave him the victory. And thirdly, let me ask you this question. You got to be in the Lord's army for it to count. Have you been born again? And that's what it's all about. This morning, if you need to respond to the invitation, the lesson's yours as we stand and sing.